And welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to the Hangout in the Holy Land. That's the official podcast of LandGrantHolyLand.com, your free premier resource for all things Ohio State news and Ohio State sports. It's good to be back, everybody. It's good to be back here behind this microphone. It's good to be back here in the SB Nation offices here in beautiful D.C. I've been out the past couple of weeks taking care of some family business, but I'm back. And I'm glad to be with you, and hopefully I didn't miss anything too earth shattering. And if I did, my man Colton here, I think, will be able to get me up to speed. What's good, buddy?
Not much, Matt. Just enjoying the summer. It's beautiful as well out here in Boulder, Colorado. We're less than 90 days from the start of college football, so we're starting to get amped up and ready to talk some Big 12, Tulane's new uniforms, some Ohio State basketball stuff, baseball just made a nice little run in the postseason, so a lot going on right now.
Yeah, this has been a pleasantly, I think, more eventful May than I was planning on. You know, when we sit down here to go set up all of our editorial planning schedules and what's going on here, I would say like mid-May and like mid-July are the two just absolute deadest parts of the calendar, especially if you cover a Big Ten team like we do, because the College World Series and college baseball is typically an afterthought. But Ohio State really made a nice run there in the end. I had really stopped paying attention by the beginning of May because I'd written this team off and was kind of really on the fire Greg Beal's bandwagon. But they got hot at the right time, and they get themselves back in the postseason for the first time in a while. It was fun.
Yeah, first Big Ten tournament title since 2007, first tournament appearance since 2009. They finished with a 44-20-1 record overall. And, you know, there was somebody, to your point about Greg Beals, there was somebody in our mentions after they lost to Wright State and were booted from the NCAA tournament who said, you know, recruits are going to look down upon this. You can't lose to Wright State in the tournament. But given where Ohio State baseball has been in the last 5 or 6 years, and even where they were early in the season where it just seemed like they were going to miss out on the tournament again, I'd say it was a pretty successful season. You have 9 seniors lost, I think, from this team heading into next year, so we'll see what happens. But I think it's always great to have another big sport like that kind of make some gains. So Ohio State baseball, hopefully a thing, you know, going forward here.
Yeah, I'm a little bit skeptical that this will be able to be sustained for next year, just because they're losing so many dudes, and Ronnie Dawson's going to go make himself a bunch of money. And ideally, Ohio State would not have needed that huge run at the end of the month just to get to the tournament, because their Big Ten schedule was super easy. The out-of-conference schedule was really pretty manageable, and this would have been the year to make that run. I think if they had missed the tournament, it would have been a huge disappointment, especially considering they probably should have made the tournament the last 2 years and really kind of fell apart at the end of the year. I'm glad they got there, and you know, that I think that buys the program a little bit of time, and we'll kind of see what happens. Probably isn't going to be a powerhouse just because of that's the way that the Big Ten is set up. But nice to have some live sporting events and something to be excited about over the last couple of weeks. Because now my friend, now things get grim. The one thing that everyone's talking about as we're recording this here on Wednesday, June 8th, a little after lunchtime, is the NCAA released their official basketball attendance figures for last basketball season. The Big Ten as a conference typically does very well here. They are once again your national attendance leader. Across the Big Ten, they averaged over 12,500 fans a game, which is great. There's a lot of Big Ten teams that have strong basketball traditions, and more importantly, have really big arenas, so you could squeeze a bunch of teams in there. I like looking at this chart every year because, one, you can gawk at some of these really hilariously low numbers for some of these smaller schools. You know, Bryant is averaging less than 500 people a game. Or there's a lot of schools here, even some of them that are not terrible small low major programs that are in the three digits. But then you want to check in with Ohio State and Colton. Ohio State struggled a little bit over the last couple of seasons. This hasn't been a dynamic product. Where do you think Ohio State sits nationally in basketball attendance?
Well, usually I would say within the top 20, but now they have to be outside the top 20 given the way the teams played, and even the home schedule hasn't been too great. So I would say around like 35.
You're pretty close. Ohio State finished at 28 this year, averaging 12,283 fans per game. And you're right. Typically, the Buckeyes are in the top 20, if not the top 10. In part because this is an enormous athletic department, but also because the shot itself is huge. You can get, you know, almost 20,000 fans in there. And that wasn't the case, but you're right. This team struggled on the court a little bit. The schedule's fallen a little bit. I think that they made some changes here with some of the seat licenses. And so fans are clearly now voicing their displeasure with their pocketbooks and with what they do on their weekday evenings and on their weekends. And I think it's particularly jarring. Because, sure, you expect Ohio State to be behind Kentucky, to be behind Louisville or North Carolina or some of these very successful basketball programs. But there's a lot of teams that finished ahead of here that aren't better than Ohio State. Nebraska sucked, and they finished 11th. They got 15,000 people in a game. BYU, an NIT-caliber team, just like Ohio State, they get over 14. Marquette wasn't that great. They're getting over 13. They're above Ohio State. Alabama, New Mexico, Utah, Dayton, Illinois, all had better attendance figures. You have to think here, if Ohio State basketball doesn't make a step forward next season, if some of the business realities of all of those empty seats might make Ohio State want to make, not fire Thad Mata, obviously, here, but be a little bit antsier about some decisions that they might be making.
Well, and I think it's a problem on many different fronts because the shot is – it's such a monstrous place and it's such a beautiful arena. I've never been inside it. I've been outside and seen just what a monstrosity it is. But for the last four or five seasons, even when the team was having success, you've heard fans talk about how compared to St. John Arena, it's just not an ideal place to watch a basketball game, at least for an atmosphere perspective. So even when they were winning, it wasn't like the place was, you know, insanely loud like it may have been in St. John when the team was really good. And it just seems like more of a professional sports environment than a college sports environment. And I know two or three years ago, and maybe it still happens today, a lot of the students were very upset about what they've done with the student section and how they kind of put more corporate sponsors up front and some of the alumni up front. And it just has given the feel that it's not a place where a high-level basketball program plays. And so when the team starts falling off a little bit like they have in the last couple of seasons, I think that problem gets exacerbated. And when you don't have a good schedule, you're going to see that show up in lagging attendance and overall displeasure with the product, especially at home.
Yeah, the sneaky little fact here, and I think most Ohio States would agree with this, is that the shot is low-key not nearly as good of a basketball venue as the Horseshoe is for football. It's really probably 3,000, 4,000 seats too big. It's so especially in those kind of early games in November and December, it feels really empty. And so it's not very loud. The students aren't placed in places where their impact is amplified. And then when you couple that with some of these other struggles, I understand why people don't want to spend $30, $35, $40 more to go to some of these games. I am optimistic that the product will be better next season. There's going to be some better teams, I think, coming to Columbus. But it is something to be a little bit nervous about. Maybe there are some changes to lower the capacity a little bit, structural changes to improve that fan experience a little bit, because you can get fans to come even if your team isn't excellent, as Nebraska and BYU and Alabama, as these other places here have shown. We'll see if Ohio State's able to get there for next season. Other than that, though, the big stories are we have to dig deep a little bit more. There's something that by the time you're listening to this, you'll have seen this column on Land Grant. Colton, did you by chance see what our friend Dennis Dodd at CBS wrote about the Big Ten's next TV deal a couple of days ago?
Well, unfortunately, with everything going on with conference expansion and Dennis Dodd being one of the foremost college football writers, you kind of have to read his stuff, you know, given his history. Don't like to, but he did have some very insightful things to say about the Big 12 and possible expansion, and then, to your point, what it means for the Big 10.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more skeptical about this thesis, but let's talk about it here a little bit, because I feel like over the last month or so, I have personally written a little bit less about Ohio State stuff and de facto been put on this Big 12 realignment beat. So as you are probably at least somewhat aware, the Big 12 is considering right now whether they want to expand by two teams, potentially even more than that, make a decision here over the summer. They've already decided we're going to have a conference championship game. Maybe we'll divide up into divisions. We're not doing the whole TV network thing, but we're going to study expanding a little bit more. So that is a decision that is expected to happen by the end of this summer. The Big Ten is working on trying to finalize their next television deal by Big Ten Media Days. That's in late July. In case you're following along there, the Big Ten has reportedly agreed to sell half of its media rights to Fox for a cool up to $500 million, and they're trying to shop the second half. So that might go to Fox again, that might go to Turner, that might go to NBC Sports, it might go to ESPN, which is what I think most fans would prefer and what certainly Big Ten coaches would prefer. But Don is saying that one wrinkle here is that if the Big 12 decides to expand, ESPN and Fox have to pay additional money to a full share to whatever new Big 12 Big 12 schools are added, even if they are not attractive television properties, like say Memphis or Central Florida or Colorado State or something like that. So if the Big 12 is paying out $25 million a year for West Virginia, they got to pay out $25 million a year for Memphis, $25 million a year for Colorado State. And over the course of that contract, that's $500 million bucks, $600 million bucks, potentially even a billion if they actually expand to 14 teams and a couple other things happen. And Dodd is saying that might actually keep that will hurt the Big Ten's ability to get a big television deal for their second section, because money will be tied up with ESPN and Fox. It could even jump them away from ESPN. So after hearing that and kind of flipping through it here, I have a bunch of more detailed thoughts, but I'm curious what your initial reaction is to that. Do you think that this would be that the Big 12 will expand or could expand, that it might the repercussions might actually dig into the Big 10's money?
I think I'm more along the lines with you, where I don't know how much credence to take this at face value. I do think that they're is a scenario where the Big Ten is kind of left out in the cold if the Big 12 does decide to expand to 14 teams. But even then, it just seems like, you know, from what he's saying, that the TV partners have to pay this money. But the one thing for me with expansion now, where's this money coming from, especially from TV networks, with people cutting the cord, moving away from the traditional way we've watched TV and watched sporting events before? It just seems like, you know, in 2 or 3 years from now, whenever the Big 12, if they do decide to expand, even if they have to in a contract pay this money, it just seems like there isn't going to be any money to go around. And if we know anything about Jim Delaney, if we know this and Dennis Dodd knows this, Jim Delaney and the rest of the high-ranking Big Ten brass, they know that this is a possibility too, and they've never really been one to get left out in the cold when it comes to this kind of stuff. So I would anticipate that they have a move ready in case they need to. And even if the Big 12 does have the upper hand, I think that they've kind of shown that they aren't smart enough to capitalize on that. So I think it's much ado about nothing, at least for right now.
So here's my thinking on this situation. I think of all of the possible outcomes for what the Big 12 might do, I think that the single most likely, and this is not something I'm super confident in, but I think the single most likely is that they don't expand at all. And one big reason for that is that 30% of all of the university presidents in this conference are interims. And I'm not sure if they're going to be able to solidify a more permanent university president and then get them up to speed in time for them to make a decision by the start of this football season. And it's a big thing to ask somebody who may not be empowered to make a really far-flung business choice here that's going to have implications far beyond their tenure if you don't think you're going to stick around for a long time. You add that to the fact that Texas has already kind of established that they're not really in favor of expanding at all. And I think it would be a little bit of an upset if if they do expand. I will also add that I just can't see any way in hell they go to 14. You hear Dave Boren, and this is the president of Oklahoma, and you hear a lot of some of these other administrators talk about how important it is to not dilute the product. You don't want to dilute fan interests. Texas fans are not going to be, interested to going to watch a football game in Storrs, Connecticut, and a crappy UConn squad, or a community college in a big city that you're hoping will eventually grow up. But will eventually kind of grow up into a more mature, established fan base. If there were that many teams available that didn't meet that benchmark, I think they would have already added some. I think you can make a compelling argument that two of those teams exist, and that would be Cincinnati and BYU, who are already competing at a football level above the average Big 12 program. And Big 12 and BYU's fan base is enormous, and their facilities are certainly strong enough to compete there. But they're certainly not four. And if you're convincing Texas and TCU and Baylor to add two more teams, I think will be difficult. Four seems I think that's too much. And if we're only adding by two, then it's $500 million at most, spread out over 8 years. And you're expecting them to do this in a timeline that's very quick before the Big Ten's timeline. I don't see it happening. And if it did, it would torpedo their relationship with those broadcast partners. Because I'll tell you one thing. ESPN would much rather sign a deal to get ESPN than sign a deal to get the bottom half of the Big 12.
Well, and to your point about the on-field product, this is something in the piece that Bob Bowlesby, the Big 12 commissioner, said. He said, quote, "If indeed we're still playing a full round robin and we have a championship game, I think our means of determining our champion is the strongest of all the conferences." And I think everybody can definitely disagree with that when you look at the history of the Big 12. But I think at the end of the day, they're more along the lines of what you're saying, Matt, is that it probably would dilute the product, and it's not like they're doing what the Big Ten did in bringing in Nebraska, or like what the SEC did bringing in Texas A&M and Missouri, teams that have had success on the Division I level. You know, how much value are you really going to get when you add in some of these smaller schools, if you add in a Memphis or you add in, like you said, UConn? So I think the most likely scenario, like you're saying, is probably the Big 12 just sticking with what they have. And it's kind of interesting that Dodd mentioned this, and you talked about how they would stay. Andy Staples and Stuart Mandel both in the past couple of weeks have written articles about how the future of college football isn't the expansion era that we saw in the last 5 years, but rather it's, you know, de-expanding everything or just decentralizing everything and conferences going even smaller, kind of back to how they were. And I don't know the feasibility of that with TV contracts and whatnot, but it seems like the era of true expansion is probably over. We'll see what the Big 12 does. But I think at this point, the smarter choice is to either stay where you are or shed dead weight.
I would be really surprised if a lot of these conferences actually started dropping teams, or even if one or two, even if those teams have dead weight, because you're bringing in, especially for places like the Big Ten or for the Pac-12 or the ACC a little bit, where the emphasis on research and academic prestige and some of that stuff and tradition is honestly not just lip service. But in terms of, yeah, I think a lot of people, and I've included a lot of bloggers and writers and journalists here, have looked at what the Big Ten did with Rutgers and Maryland and assume that that is something that can be reproduced by other conferences. And by that, I mean adding some not very good football programs, or in the case of Rutgers, not very good at literally anything, but near big cities, and that would lead to TV profit. And I've written about this, and I've tweeted about this, and I've talked about this, that there really were kind of exceptions. And a similar approach with the Pac-12 that brought in two, you know, better athletic programs in interesting cities did not bring them wealth. And it hasn't really been the case at the lower level of college athletics in terms of like G5 conferences as well, because of where alumni are concentrated or the way that their specific television networks are set up. So I don't really know how a lot of this is going to go. I would not be surprised if the Big 12 adds BYU and Cincinnati. I would not be surprised if the Big 12 adds affiliate members so they can keep some more of that profit internally. That might actually make the most sense for somebody like a BYU, which has some political issues. But I would be very surprised, no matter what they do, if that ends up having a really deleterious effect on what the Big Ten wants to do. If the Big Ten and the ESPN aren't able to figure something out, I would be very surprised if the reason is because ESPN's money is tied up in paying Cincinnati.
So do you think that, and this is something that Mandel and Andy Staples both mentioned in their articles, that it would, you know, we would kind of get rid of the idea of conferences and we would come under what Mandel called the college football playoff confederation? How hard of a sell do you think it is to a team like Oklahoma State or South Carolina that, hey, you can still play in the SEC or the Big 12 in basketball, but when it comes to football, you're not on that same level? Do you think that's something that is just totally not feasible at all, that these schools will just completely revolt to that idea?
Yeah, I do. I this has been floated a couple of times. It's a perfectly fine off-season, you know, kind of thing to write, you know, just as a thought exercise. But I don't think it's very realistic, and in part because of that reason. The that kind of middle class tier would never support it, and that could threaten to break up these conferences for some other sports. And I think it would be a tough sell even for some of these big ones. I think it would be tough sell to Ohio State even if they said, hey, we're going to go jump and join this confederation with 32 other teams, but we're never going to play Iowa, we're never going to play Indiana, we're never going to play some of these teams that we've been together with for 80 years.
Say goodbye to the Illibuck.
Yeah, like I mean, like people actually do care about that a little bit. I mean, that's part of the reason why many fans were upset about Maryland and Rutgers was because there is a historical, traditional tie to some of these Big West programs. So if you're going to throw all of that away for annual games with like Arkansas or Auburn or something, I maybe this is me being a little bit naive, and I'm sure that some programs and administrations would welcome it. I think that would ultimately be a very tough sell across this entire sport, and I don't think it's practical.
Oh, absolutely, and I think too that if I wanted to go watch that product, I'll watch the NFL, and it is naive, and it's kind of a very old school way to think. In that, you know, if Ohio State played Alabama or an A&M every week and you only had 32 teams of the Blue Bloods, on paper, like, great, that's awesome, but that's what the NFL does. And if I want to go watch that product's already out there for me. And the fact that, you know, we get to see Ohio State still play Purdue every once in a while or Minnesota or Northwestern, it's stupid that we like it, but we like it because it's college football.
Yeah, the provincialism. This is something that my colleagues Stephen Godfrey and Bill Connolly, who have another very good football podcast you should listen to, the podcast Dan Played Nobody, they talk about that a lot. It's not just the football and the diversity of the styles of football that make this interesting, or the high caliber of athletes. It is that regionalism. It's that uniqueness. It's that history and tradition that make this fun. And we've already really kind of taken away from that a little bit over the last 5 or 6 years. In a couple of ways, I think in a positive direction with the college football playoff, and also in some negative directions with the proliferation of neutral site games, with the breaking up of some really good historical college football rivalries with some of these weird conference realignment changes. That might continue a little bit. It's difficult to see us going to the end tier of the kind of confederations that Mandel and Staples were projecting. But who knows? You know, I have been wrong on literally, you know, thousands of things about sports since I started doing this. I could be wrong about this. That is the, you know, that's definitely something that we're going to follow a little, you know, more very closely, I think, because that really what's going on with the Big 12 is the single biggest national college football story over the next couple of months, unless you still want to write about satellite camps, and I would rather jab a fork into my eye than write one more goddamn thing about a camp.
I think at this point, the only thing to write about satellite camps is whatever sweet throwback jersey Jim Harbaugh is wearing. Because I must say, don't like the coach, don't know anything about the man. He seems kind of crazy. I was thinking he may be – I think he's at 100% full-strength dad right now. He seems like a very, very unbeatable dad.
I'm gonna have to get some of those jerseys. His dad game is absolutely just, you know, obliterating mine. I have to respect the hustle to get like a, you know, a mid '90s Allen Iverson basketball jersey, and then just cram that down your khakis. Like, okay, we can talk about that. We can respect it, or we can mock it mercilessly. That's fine. I just don't give a shit anymore about who's camping where and everything. And you know, I wrote thousands of words about that in March and April, and I guess I'll do it again next year when the NCAA makes some changes. But I would gladly write another think piece about Memphis television markets than touch that again. And things are quiet everywhere else. Like, we haven't really had any big Ohio State recruiting stories in a while. I'm not expecting another commitment for probably at least the next 2 weeks. And the word around the campfire is, like, you know, this is going to be a really small recruiting class. It wouldn't shock me if there's only maybe two more commitments till the season starts.
One, the big news coming this weekend, Tate Martell, the quarterback from Bishop Gorman in Las Vegas, announced that he is going to visit Ohio State this week. Martell, the former Texas A&M commit, the top-rated dual-threat quarterback on 24/7 Sports. How serious should Ohio State fans take, one, this visit? Is there any sort of commitment possibility, not this weekend, but in the next couple of months? And where do you think that they stand as it pertains to Martell?
I would not expect a quick commitment in this particular case. You know, Martell's somebody who has not been shy about attracting attention to this process, and look, that's fine. I'm not going to make pejorative statements about a kid, you know, getting to enjoy what I think any of us would probably like. And my thinking at this point is that Ohio State is firmly in the mix for his services. They could get him, but they're going to have a stiff challenge from both USC and Cal, who can not only offer a more direct path to playing time, but also has the advantage of an assistant connection with their new offensive coordinator, who left from Texas A&M, and he was close to Martell. So. Martell's definitely at the top of Ohio State's board. It's really him and Kellen Mond, the former Baylor commitment, another highly regarded dual threat kind of guy. Those seem to be really the other two guys here left. I don't know if Ohio State's going to be able to jump in on anybody else. They already have a quarterback, though. So I guess let me ask you, do you really think they need to take a second one? What do you think about Danny Clark, Ohio State's current quarterback commitment, as somebody who, you know, to potentially play a role in Ohio State?
Well, I think that for right now, it seems like they're set. I don't know. Yeah, they must really want one of these kids, because it seems like they've made a push for Mond in the last couple of weeks, as with Martell. And Danny Clark has been – it feels like Danny Clark's been committed for two or three years now. I remember
since he got the
tattoo on his arm and calls himself the prototype. And it's been fun following his career before he comes to Ohio State. So it seems like they're set. But if there's anything we've learned about – this offense, and maybe it's going to be different going forward a little bit with Tim Beck and whoever else is coaching up the quarterbacks, but we've seen Braxton Miller get hurt, we've seen JT Barrett get hurt, we've seen that this offense, as it pertains to running quarterbacks, can take a bit of a toll. So you can never have too many, and I think Urban Meyer, he's been in that position before at Florida, where he needed a quarterback and didn't have one. So I think they're thinking more along the lines of, let's offer as many of these high-level quarterbacks as we can, and if they all end up in the program, you know, if they transfer, then whatever, but at least we have options. So I think they're probably in a good place going forward right now. I still, and we talked about this on our last podcast, I still don't know about the current situation with who they have, just because of the unknowns behind JT Barrett, but I think the more options they have, the better.
I actually wrote about this a couple of weeks ago. Given that this might be a recruiting class that's at most maybe 20 kids, potentially smaller than that, spending two scholarships on a quarterback seems like a pretty big luxury, and maybe not the most efficient use of that space. Given that Ohio State signed their highest caliber recruit as a quarterback in Dwayne Haskins in like 10 years. And they already have two behind JT Barrett. So if JT Barrett sticks around another year, suddenly that depth chart gets a little bit crowded. I do like the idea of bringing in somebody who's a little bit more of a run first option, given that Haskins and Burrow are, and Clark for that matter, are more traditional, like not statues. Ohio State hasn't, you know, isn't recruiting Byron Leftwich or anything, but having somebody who's a little bit more of a Braxton Miller type in the quarterback room would be a useful thing. Having either Mond or Martell on Ohio State would be very exciting and everything. But just for me personally, I still like Danny Clark. As somebody who commits as a freshman, gets a tattoo, is as involved in Ohio State's program as he has been, I would like to see him stay with the program, even if he only ends up being kind of a millionaire's, you know, backup, you know, a rich man's backup, rich man's Kenny Guyton kind of situation. I think that would be a good use of the scholarship, but we're going to see. Like I have a suspicion that things are going to get. They're going to change a lot this summer and potentially into the high school football season at that position group.
Well, and like you're saying, it seems like I think the program now with the scholarships finally replenished from the last couple of years in the Tressel era, sanctions on scholarship numbers, everything now kind of seems on the up and up. They're good to go, and they kind of do seem like they are just throwing out scholarship offers every once in a while as a luxury because they're so stocked with 4- and 5-star kids at almost every position. I know the offensive line recruiting hasn't been as elite for the most part, but those are still very good kids they're bringing in. So I think they're kind of at that Alabama LSU point where every once in a while they're going to throw out an offer at positions that they're pretty stacked up on just because they can and because the kid is so good.
Yeah, it's gonna be a weird summer. It's gonna be different than the last couple of years. You know, cause if there's only like 6 or 7 spots left, it's gonna be more of a question of who are they keeping, rather than who they're getting. Whoever ends up in this group, even if it only is 19, 20, 21 kids, it still may very well end up being the top-rated class in the country. Certainly a good chance to still be better than Michigan's. So these are definitely rich people problems in the world of college football. And that's something to really be worried about. I think that's all the big news here. Is there anything else that you want to talk about?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a couple off-the-wall subjects I have to get to before we get out of here. First and foremost, are you a big college football preview magazine type of guy? I know that Bill Connolly from SB Nation, he's been doing his excellent previews for the past couple of seasons. Right now, I think we're finally in the ACC Georgia Tech today. So if you haven't checked those out, you absolutely should, because you're going to learn a lot more about college football and every single team than you would anything otherwise. But I'm still a magazine type of guy where I like to have it in my hands. And is there any one, if you had to pick one, that you prefer?
So I read Bill Connolly's previews every day. Spoiler alert, when I'm doing a radio hit or if I have to write a column about a team that's like not in the Big Ten or some other kind of preview thing, that is my first and biggest resource where I'm going. I get the Phil Steele magazine because I'm a member of the FWAA. But I'll be honest with you, I typically flip through it for about 15 minutes and then it stays on my bookshelf because the format is so impossible to read and some of the data is already outdated by the time you get it in. I guess the Phil Steele comes out in like 3 weeks. So and other than that, I don't buy any other ones because I think between Connolly and between some of the stuff at the Power Rank and I don't need the print edition as much. It sounds like this is a bigger deal for you, though.
Matt, speaking of Phil Steele, did you know that in 2002, Eli Manning surpassed Ole Miss's career passing mark and threw for over 12,000 yards to become the Rebels' all-time leading passer?
I did not. Thank you, Phil.
But I recently picked up – dude, I'm so starved for college football. I bought all 5 of the Athlon Power 5 previews, SEC, ACC, buddy. Big 12, Big 10 – Pac-12, and I'm reading through the Big Ten run right now, and they're very good. And if you want to check out Bill Connolly's writing, is in there. There's an excellent article on Nick Saban and comparing him historically to Bear Bryant. Stephen Godfrey, also from SB Nation, has written a few things in there. But I'm reading the Big Ten one right now, and I just finished Minnesota yesterday, and there was a couple of choice quotes in there that I want to get to, and I know that you have takes on Tracy Clays just like I do. And the first one was, quote, Clay's once road graders on the O-line, and he felt the Gophers' recruiting approach had focused too much on pass blocking. And if you know anything about watching Minnesota football, I would say focusing on pass blocking and passing in general isn't really what Minnesota does. And so to see that written and to see that quote kind of makes me question Minnesota and their offense with another year of Mitch Leidner in that offensive line and kind of the feasibility of him leading that football program in the next couple of seasons or even past this year.
They just got a new athletic director. I would not be shocked if he gets canned if the Gophers go 500 this year, which they might because they're not very good.
Well, and I think the best thing to one of the most enjoyable things about those magazines is they have a section for every team that says has anonymous coach in the conference sizes up opposing team or whoever they're talking about. And my favorite quote about Minnesota was, quote, their offense just seems like it's running into a brick wall, but that's just kind of who they are.
That's been who Minnesota is basically as long as I've been alive. And they had the Lawrence Maroney year, and they were pretty good at it. And then other than that, you know, the huge Minnesota wins that I could think of are pretty slim. I will gladly spend another 30 minutes here shitting on Minnesota football and their thievery of the Big Ten Coach of the Year award, which was a travesty and a sham. But I think we're running a little bit long here, so we should probably wrap up here for these good people. So we have something to talk about here for our next episode.
Absolutely. We wanted to get to the new angry ass Green Wave mascot and helmet logo for Tulane. That's something I think we could spend a whole episode on.
Let's very quickly talk about that, and then we'll end on that. I assume that the general feeling for both of us is we are pro Angry Wave. Is that accurate?
Roll damn angry ass Green Wave, man.
Somebody on Twitter said that it looks kind of like a Pokemon, which is would be very on brand here for us. I could definitely see that. I'm happy for Tulane, man. They've come a long way since I was living on Broadway Street, a couple blocks from campus, and there were, you know, 200 people at those football games for the Superdome, and you could hear it when somebody else farted three rows away. And now that they got their own stadium, they got a new coach. They're gonna play some exciting option football. They're playing Ohio State in a couple of years. You know, I'm hoping for good things for Tulane.
Well, and it seems like every single year, I know for at least the last 2 years, they've unveiled either a new logo or a new helmet, and every single time I said, wow, that's really nice, but now this one with the Green Wave, monster, Pokemon, whatever it is, it's badass. But what would its top move be if it were a Pokemon?
Probably Surf, right?
I mean, it would have to have Surf. You could use Hydro Pump, too. Hydro Cannon for the newer Pokemon games.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it feels like if you could equip that thing with Ice Beam, it would do a lot of damage.
So it's a Green Wave. Let me think about this here. So I'm thinking some kind of poison attack. If a wave is green, it's probably maybe a little bit polluted. So maybe you give it Surf and Toxic. And it's an angry wave. So maybe Thrash. So if you got Ice Beam, Thrash, Surf, and Toxic, and you give that Pokemon a strong special attack, maybe some strong special teams, I could do some damage.
That sounds like Gary's worst nightmare.
Yeah, it'll just mess everybody up. And now I kind of want to go hang up and go play Pokemon for a little bit. See if I could duck into a conference room where I could fire up the old emulator and not attract any interest. So, Colton, this has been great. It's been great getting back on the microphone, getting great talk with all you guys. We will have some more stories this week about Michigan. We will have some more stories about Big Ten television and the sports business side of everything. We are going to have some more stories here about Ohio State non-revenue sports and, of course, our daily recruiting updates. So be sure to follow us on Twitter at LandGrant33. Follow us on Facebook. You can follow me at Matt SBN and our show on Blog Talk Radio or iTunes or wherever else you can download podcasts. In that case, after that, Colton, it's been great, 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 great having you, back, great being back. We'll catch up with you here soon.
Sounds good. Roll damn Bucks.
Roll damn Green Wave.